It's The Wonky Show. There's big new proposals on harassment and sexual misconduct. We'll get across the detail. Tonti Blair's back with a new national purpose. We'll see what that's all about. Plus housing in Nottingham, it's all coming up.
Things haven't changed, and I think that's the thing. If you look at the evidence that OFS are drawing on, the most recent survey, I think it was 2020, 2021, and it was the part taken from the National Crime Survey, where full-time students were the occupational group most likely to have experienced sexual assault. And I think it was something like 8%, which is an incredibly high proportion. So what's gone before in terms of impact?
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to weigh up this week's dollop of regulatory burden, as usual, three terrific guests. In Nottingham, Paul Greatrix is Registrar at the University of Nottingham. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was talking to Professor Andy Westwood at Manchester University to record a delightful podcast in the series My Imaginary University. He was fantastic. It was great fun.
Excellent stuff. And there's a link to that in the show notes, at least a link to the feed. I'm not sure if you've published that episode yet, Paul, but terrific podcast. Link to the feed in the show notes. In Gravesend, Selena Bolingbroke is an HE consultant. Selena, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. I've been doing a bit of holiday planning and I'm doing a Yorkshire road trip. And I managed to get myself a ticket on the Flying Scotsman, which will be travelling through Keighley and Worth Valley Railway in mid-May, celebrating its 100-year anniversary. So I'm super excited about that.
Very excited. We're looking forward to a vlog. And in Ilkeston this week, Wonky's editor, Debbie McVittie. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's date night at the House of McLeach tonight, so we are very excited to get out, just the two of us, after 9 months of baby care.
Oh, very excited. What are you doing? Where are you going?
We are going to a local Italian place to drink a bottle of Chianti.
Very good.
Possibly more than one.
Excellent. So, yes, we start this week with harassment and sexual misconduct. OFS has some dramatic new proposals for providers in England, Selena.
Yes, OFS has published a consultation today which updates the sector on its expectations of HE providers in terms of the prevention and management of harassment and sexual misconduct. So, they had introduced a kind of voluntary code back in April 2021. They clearly don't think that progress has been sufficient to date, and they had done an independent evaluation to look at what improvements had been made. And what they found was that there was still a great deal of inconsistency across the sector. So this consultation proposes really quite radical new conditions in that they are proposing a new condition of registration for providers. And I mean, this is something that if you look at the evidence of the problem, which is in the consultation paper itself, this is something that has been not just going on, but has been documented for many, many years now, going all the way back to the NUS report, Hidden Marks, back in 2010. So I think for a lot of people, this will be an important piece of OFS regulation. And there's a number of different aspects of that condition of registration, but a couple of things really stand out there. And one of the things is that there would be regulatory requirements in relation to staff-student relationships, and that there should be an obligation on institutions to not just have a single policy document, but to ensure that there is sufficient resource and capacity to comply with that condition of registration. So I think really important, there's a 2 or 3 month consultation period on this, but this is something that I think a lot of people have said has been wanting for a long time now.
Debbie, this has been, you know, as Selena says, this has been a long time coming. Are we clear on why it's taken this long? Is it that it's taken this long because it was right for providers to, you know, try and kind of sort this out beforehand? Is OFS overcooking the problem? You know, what's really going on here in terms of that gap between Hidden Marks and today?
Well, I think some of this is about trying to understand what's in the power of providers to do. And I think it's really, really important that you kind of disaggregate the topic itself, harassment and sexual misconduct. You know, everybody, nobody disagrees. You know, perhaps harassers and people who engage in sexual misconduct disagree. But, you know, the vast majority of people agree that these are not things that we would like to see on our university campuses. Then the other question is, OK, well, what are the right things for universities and students' unions to do to try and not only kind of support people who are affected by it, but also try and kind of reduce it overall. And I think genuinely, it's taken quite a long time to figure out what that is, because some of this is about culture, some of this is about reporting systems, some of this is about sort of trust in universities to be able, you know, it's about developing the expertise in universities. So as much as it is frustrating, I think for those of us who've been kind of there since 2009 and kind of watching this unfold, I think you can't fault the efforts that have gone on to try and figure out what are the things that can be done. And I think it continues to be interesting to, I will be really, really interested to see what the impact of making it regulatory is, because I think where universities have really stepped up, they've done lots of stuff about, you know, about developing that expertise and that support systems, about, you know, bystander training. All of these things require evaluation, and they require kind of a degree of sustainability. I think the thing that happens when you make it a regulatory requirement is you make it, you consistent practice across the sector, and you ensure that funding is made available to sustain things that are working quite well. I think the other thing that happens when you introduce it as a regulatory requirement is that it becomes very much about demonstrating compliance with regulation, and not necessarily some of the stuff that we would have seen in the past about changing cultures and leadership and all the rest of it. So, it's you know, it all comes down to theory of change ultimately.
Yes, Paul, you're an aficionado of higher education regulation, and actually you've got a blog on the site this week about regulatory burden. What's your view here on what undoubtedly is a significant extension of powers being proposed by OFS into an area that it perhaps hasn't really gone into before in terms of regulation?
I think to Debbie's point, right, the important thing about this is, you know, this is an issue which the sector has to grapple with, has been grappling with for many, many, many years, and it's entirely proper it becomes the focus of attention. And I suppose my anxiety with this is that, and I was genuinely surprised to discover that this was coming out as a consultation. And it's one of those consultations that you know what the answer is as soon as they publish the document, because it's 80 pages long, or however long it is, very long. You know, so we know what the answer is going to be here. But I was genuinely surprised at the extent and the reach of it. And I suppose the fundamental issue for me is that the sector has sought to get its house in order, recognizing that its track record was woeful over many years, but has spent really in the last 7 years, I would say, since the beginning of the change in the culture work that UUK has led, with all universities and colleges involved, has been really focusing on this across a range of areas, not just sexual harassment, but beyond that as well. So I'm frankly disappointed to suddenly feel that we're charging down the regulatory route. And I fear, well, you can't regulate a culture in, right? If what we're seeking, and I absolutely agree with this, is cultural change, it takes time and it has to happen within university. And the regulating of it will not actually deliver that. So it feels to me we're moving down a road which is fundamentally about an administrative, bureaucratic compliance approach, which I fear will actually not enhance the arrangements in universities for addressing this really, really difficult problem. And I think I'd be really interested to hear what colleagues have to say about the staff-student relationship thing as well, and the role of a regulator in addressing that particular issue, which I think is, you know, the big press focus on this has been around that. I think it goes far, far further than that, but it's a really interesting dimension of this proposed regulation.
Yes, I mean, look, on the staff-student relationships thing, so obviously OFS has got two proposals here on the table, and it's expressed a preference for one of them. One of them is effectively to kind of declare and register so that a university, OFS is confident the university is managing a conflict of interest, and then the other is effectively a ban. And already on Twitter this morning, I see the usual kind of whataboutery around a kind of blanket ban. So, you know, there are two questions, Selena, aren't there? One is, should OFS be in this space at all? And then if it is, where should it be requiring universities and colleges to draw that line? Should it be about managing conflict of interest, or should there be, you know, a much bigger kind of blanket ban?
I believe there should be a blanket ban. And I mean, I hear what Paul says in terms of OFS kind of getting involved in an area of regulation, and the fact that institutions are, you know, well motivated and have made some progress. But From my perspective, I think that we've gone through a kind of at least a decade of a lot of debate, a lot of awareness raising. And I think we need, things haven't changed. And I think that's the thing. If you look at the evidence that OFS are drawing on, the most recent survey, I think, was 2020, 2021, and it was the part taken from the National Crime Survey, where full-time students were the occupational group most likely to have experienced sexual assault. And I think it was something like 8%, which is an incredibly high proportion. So what's gone before in terms of impact hasn't worked. And I think the thing about culture is that sometimes you have to have very hard boundaries and lines to signal and to symbolise wider culture change. And personally, I think the most powerful tool that institutions have around this is to recognise the implicit power imbalance in staff and student relationships, not just where there's a direct relationship, but indeed where there is an indirect relationship, and to outlaw that. And I think certainly from, you know, my days of when I was a full-time administrator within a university setting, I would have preferred to have implemented that ban than have implemented a kind of register situation that needed constant policing and was, you know, going to be subject to a high level of subjectivity around some of that. I think sometimes you do need black and white lines here. And I think that would be a very, very powerful move. And I certainly think that the gains would far outweigh the costs.
Debbie, that's very interesting, isn't it, from a regulatory design point of view. And to some extent, this is playing out on social media already this morning, because if you have something that's really kind of blunt and you know, kind of, you know, zeros and ones, then the danger is that the complexity in what really happens on campus that's perfectly legitimate kind of gets lost. On the other hand, if you have something that's really complicated, you don't send clear signals, and then, you know, kind of abusers, if you like, find their way round things. And this question in terms of regulatory design, that's not a question that's exclusive to this issue. This is a question that concerns all sorts of things that OFS says and does in relation to metrics and God knows what else, where when it's really simple and clear, people moan it's not being kind of complex and subtle enough. And when it's complex and subtle, people moan that it's not being clear enough.
I think there's something going on here about, and I don't know whether it's good faith or bad faith, but that sort of thing about people sort of taking the policy for the reality. You know, where you say, well, if we have to ban staff-student relationships, then how could someone, you know, join the university? You know, how could the partner of a professor join the university to take a short course? And you're like, well, that, I mean, they could, couldn't they? Because that's not how policy works. You know, the power of the signal of a ban says this is broadly unacceptable. But the reality also is that it is perfectly possible to create exceptions, to manage anomalies, to interpret in such a way as you can kind of do the right thing. But without, you know, and maintain the sort of spirit of something without perhaps maintaining the letter of it. And I think this is where also, I mean, I continue, and you talk about the full sort of breadth of OFS regulatory activity, and I have a lot of sympathy with those who kind of worry about the risks inherent in being a little bit overinterpretive of what's going on with things like metrics and you know, the various regulatory conditions. But I do think that sometimes universities have a little bit more power to interpret and implement in the sort of spirit than they think they do. And some of that is about tone, and some of that is about you know, creative thinking, and there's obviously a kind of line and that, you know, beyond which you're going too far, and not knowing where that is, it creates challenges. But you know, I think I agree with Selena that fundamentally the kind of signal that a ban sends is incredibly important to establishing that boundary. And then, you know, where the grey areas exist, you can kind of figure that out.
Paul, one of the other things that I think is really interesting in here is this idea that what providers will have to do to kind of demonstrate that they've kind of, you know, complied with the condition is effectively carry out a risk assessment, but not a risk assessment that, you know, of the sort that's the kind of thing that would normally appear on the, you know, the agenda of university council or whatever, but a risk assessment in relation to students, you know, which students in which settings are more likely to experience sexual misconduct or harassment and which are least likely to report. That's actually, to be fair, I think, unless I'm missing something, that's a fairly new idea across the sector, even where universities are quite well ahead on this approach.
It is a new idea. And I come back to this issue that it's fundamentally a very difficult issue to try and regulate a cultural change. And what is being sought here is, you know, basically a bureaucratic mechanism for addressing this very, very challenging issue. And I mean, what will happen in my real concern about this is what will happen is that the many, many institutions that have really embraced this issue and sought to really change their culture and to address all of the problems that have been raised over the years, the issues that have been raised by particularly female students about their treatment at the hands of other students and at the hands of staff and in the environments in which they live and study, right? All of those issues which everyone's, you know, really grappling with and said, actually, we now have to look at something slightly different because our primary concern will be compliance, right? Because our primary aim will to be ensure that we maintain, we meet the conditions of registration. So added value actually becomes less valuable. You don't get extra points in the eyes of the OFS for exceeding the requirements of the condition. And that's my concern. And the risk assessment may be a great idea. It may be a really, really good approach. And I think that many institutions would like to try it out. Actually, if it's a requirement, it turns into something very difficult. Let me take the one example, though, with come back to staff-student relationships thing, because I think it's really interesting. I have a very strong personal view in this, which is I agree with Selena and Debbie. I think they should be banned. However, I've seen debates in universities around the country where, you know, there has been really a lot of focus on this, and very few universities, I think, now have actually come out with an outright ban, because it is quite difficult to do. And part of the reason is the nuance that Debbie articulated. But also, we've got communities of people with different views. And I have to say, I'm not wholly convinced that imposing a ban is the right way to do it. I'm even less convinced, I have to say, that a national register of staff-student relationships, which is what the other option is the way forward either. But I think it's right that universities all are required to discuss this issue again, because I think they need to adopt it themselves rather than have it imposed.
Debbie, let me ask you this other question. One of the things I think is fascinating in here is OFS is going quite far in requiring certain types of training and development and this is the word it uses, teaching for students and training for students, both on understanding of the terms here and also, the kind of bystander training thing. I mean, this idea that in pursuit of something that isn't directly related to your course, the national regulator is telling universities that they effectively have to do some curriculum stuff on the study environment. That's major and big, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, I suppose it depends whether you interpret it as being curriculum. I'm fairly relaxed about the idea of the curriculum including, in fact, I'm actually a bit of an advocate for it, if anything, including what is essentially personal development. You know, how to being a good citizen, you know, living in community with others and contributing to that community. I think all of that is kind of very much within the gift of higher education to put into the curriculum. Creates, I think, probably some quite good outcomes if it's done well and thoughtfully and all the rest of it. Yes, I suppose the idea that the regulator can kind of mandate this in some way, I think, is probably a bit more problematic, and that's legitimate. I mean, and also a point you made in your blog this morning, Jim, about the idea that this is about kind of identifying how universities will protect students. And I think that actually there is a genuine kind of language issue there. I think that kind of idea about educating is a much more kind of useful idea for a university to be doing, because I'm not sure, well, first of all, I'm not sure that a university can protect students. I also worry, I think, as you imply in your piece, that we're talking about a group of students, primarily but not exclusively women, who need to be protected from another group of students, primarily but not exclusively men. And of course, we know that some of that language is disempowering for women. It can also lead to victim blaming. And this idea that, you know, that unless you protect yourself, you're essentially leaving yourself open to harassment and misconduct. And so on and so forth. So I think this idea that, you know, we educate the community about what is appropriate behaviour is actually the right way to go. And it might be quite helpful to finesse the language in order to kind of indicate to universities that you know, that is something that we would be kind of welcomed.
And one other thing, Selena, we sort of knew this was coming because it's the same formulation that OFS has used on over a number of issues. But seeing it in print, I think, is fascinating. This idea that even if your only relationship with another provider is to validate the degrees, you have to make sure that your policy is being upheld by the provider, even if it's in another country or whatever. You know, that is going to create some really interesting challenges, isn't it, when we're talking about years abroad or placement providers or, you know, franchise or validation arrangements. This is interesting new space.
Yeah, I think it kind of does provide some challenges. There's always been challenges around sort of partnership-based education. I think probably more so than the validation scenario is the workplace scenario, because of the potential for some kind of either dual process or conflict in process with work-based policies. And actually, I think that was one of the things I was thinking when Debbie was talking about the sort of mandatory training requirement and whether or not it's, you know, curriculum-based or outside the curriculum. I think what's important there is actually this kind of education is about preparation for work, for, you know, this isn't going to be an issue that is just relevant at university. But you're right, with all of these things, there is going to be some complexity in terms of the way in which it's delivered and who takes responsibility. But validating institutions have probably got comparable situations to draw upon in terms of the way in which they delineate with their partner who takes responsibility, and that there is, if you like, a sort of single interface from a student perspective.
Paul, just one other thing. Once, you know, from a thin end of the wedge point of view, once it becomes, you know, okay for the regulator to say universities must kind of teach and train students on X, where X isn't directly related to the kind of program, you know, probably most weeks we review a PDF, a report from someone that says there ought to be training or education on X, Y, and Z in universities that relates to students as citizens or the climate or, you know, all sorts of things. Is this a thin end of the wedge? Is the danger here that everyone over the next 15 years will pile in and say, well, we want universities now to do X for all your students or Y for all students? Or is this one so important that this one can kind of stand alone?
I always fear using the thin end of the wedge argument, but I you've got it bang on, Jim. And my concern would be exactly that. I mean, once you get essentially government or an arm of government telling universities what to teach, then we are in, you know, really, really difficult territory here, right? And I absolutely get the argument that we do need to ensure that our students, you know, are properly provided to enable them to make, with the education, to enable them to make, you know, a normal, an appropriate contribution to university and community life. And that's fine. But fundamentally, it has to be to each university to determine how to do that in their own way. Otherwise, we end up in national curriculum territory. We end up with government deciding what goes in chemistry and French degrees. And we might as well all pack up and go home, because you're seeing the terminal decline of UK higher education. So, yes, it is the thin end of the wedge.
Well, fascinating stuff. Good. Lots more coverage on the site. But for now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michelle Morgan, and I'm a student experience transition specialist who is the Dean of Students at the University of East London. I've been blogging for Wonky this week about the need to introduce a sector-wide approach in monitoring intermissions and withdrawals of students in higher education to understand the impact of the cost of living crisis. I called for it during the COVID-19 pandemic, but this is now something the Students APPG inquiry launched by Paul Blomfield really needs to investigate as a matter of urgency. There is already a wealth of long-standing research highlighting the impact of disadvantage in higher education amongst certain groups without any crisis occurring. And already we're starting to see valuable research coming through looking at the impact of the cost of living on different groups. For universities who have a large number of students from disadvantaged backgrounds, this will further impact on progression, retention and outcomes, and the all-important metrics that are used to weigh, measure, judge and rank universities. The reasons why collecting systematic data is so important is that every institution collects and records reasons for intermission, change in study mode and withdrawal differently. And the categories universities have to complete their HESA returns are broad and quite basic. We know a student's decision to stop studying is often complex with no single cause. And it is this complexity that is very much at the heart of discussion at this year's Secret Life of Students being held on the 14th of March at the Shaw Theatre. So if you haven't booked your ticket, do so quickly and be part of the discussion to help support our students and our higher education community.
Now, next up, there's a new report from the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, and it looks like Tonti has been for a pint with former party leader, Tory party leader, Lord Ague. Paul, what's the upshot of all this?
Well,
This is the second report in 2 days, which took me by surprise. I wasn't expecting this. I certainly wasn't expecting Tony Blair and William Hague to be going for multiple pints together and coming up with this kind of thing. I have to say, I was really impressed. It's a substantial piece of work by a very, very well-organized and disciplined and well-read group of policy wonks who've come up with a whole series of recommendations about rebuilding and reshaping government and the state around the idea that science and technology is at the heart of future economic and social success and a means of driving innovation throughout the economy and throughout government. There's a ton of stuff in there. And a lot of it seems to me to be really well thought through, sensible policy proposals. And what's really, really interesting about it, and there is loads of stuff, they highlight the areas the UK's fallen behind, but highlights real areas of strength as well. The things that excited me most about it, to be honest, and again, I must stress, I am genuinely surprised at how good I think this is, and others better informed may say, no, it's full of holes. But it does stress the vital role of higher education in all of this, and the critical contribution of graduates to the UK's productivity and to the economy, the importance of educational technologies in enhancing learning experience in both schools and universities, the vital need for long-term investment in research and development. And this is at a time when we've suddenly seen money go out the door only yesterday, which is a real concern. And incentives in terms of talent attraction, that's about providing an attractive visa regime so we get the best academics from across the world, the best researchers, and also the best future employees in this country, again, which runs counter to the current anti-immigration narrative. More about STEM in universities as well as in schools and getting more women into technology. And a really interesting line as well about course approval routes in universities and how long it takes to get a new course approved. So it's a kind of really niche higher education stuff. So overall, I think there's an awful lot in there, which is really, really exciting. But also a lot of it is common sense writ large as well. So a sense of real excitement. And I have to say, I'm surprised and really, really chuffed to have read it. I think it's super.
Yes. I mean, I don't know about you, Debbie, and obviously you've written a piece on the report on the site. But when I was reading it, I was actually kind of almost viscerally rejecting it in the way that a body might reject the medicine, because it just seemed so optimistic, you know, visionary. It seemed to have its analysis bang on. It kind of felt like it didn't exist in the real world as a result.
Yeah, I think this is kind of what I was wrestling with as well, because I was reading and I was thinking, this is cracking. You know, imagine, imagine if we had policy that was this. You know, because I think it's also fair to say, and I think I sort of touch on this in the piece this morning a little bit. You know, that unless you personally are across the detail of, you know, artificial intelligence, biotech, climate tech, ed tech, you know, you can't assess each of its claims on you know. There may be kind of moments where, you know, people who were deeply into any one of those fields might say, okay, well, actually, this is a little thin, because that's the nature. But that is the nature of policy. That is how, you know, by bringing these things together in a way that is kind of thinking about radical change, is, you know, that's sort of often what happens, is you do skirt over some of the nuance and detail on the specifics. And that's okay. That's fine. But yes, I'm sort of thinking, okay, so not only are we've become so cynical, we've become so inured to sort of surface level populist, trying to kind of sell things that are very much kind of turd polished versions of policy, that the idea that you could actually do something meaningful to change people's lives in the way that Hague and Blair outline, and that you could do it with a kind of cross-party consensus, you know, it just feels like it's for the birds. And this is kind of why I sort of said, you know, all this is where I think it's a question about how do universities pick, you know, I think there's quite an interesting opportunity for universities here, because some of these areas that talk about the role of universities, so first of all, you know, let's celebrate that and recognise that, you know, how very, very important universities might be to the sort of future that's very infused around science and technology. But also let's think about where universities could push this debate forward. And also where universities might actually even take some of the insight here and apply it in their own context. Because I think actually, if there's any organisations of the state, with the caveat, of course, universities are not organisations of the state, but, you know, there's an awful lot that they could do to adopt some of this thinking within their own organisations. And that might even kind of demonstrate some of the possibilities of what happens when you do that. So that kind of embedding of of technology across the full breadth of the mission of the university, the organizing of activity around the idea that, you know, science and technology are going to be what's defining the future of British citizens, and they need to not only engage with it in a kind of meaningful way to, you know, for efficiency purposes, but actually for innovation purposes. You know, it's a really exciting prospect, actually.
Yes. Now, on all of that, Selina, let's, you know, obviously Paul and Debbie are very excited about this, but let's try and land on Earth, shall we? So just to read from Debbie's blog this morning, there's a lot of scope for universities to take the initiative on some of the arguments here and so on, but there is a case to be made that the problems of the British state can sometimes be seen inside universities too. Multiple departments working on similar problems, but from different perspectives. A long-established hierarchy that limits fresh thinking. Central bureaucracies that are designed for accountability rather than supporting innovation. You know, add all of that to everyone's knackered. There's an industrial relations problem and there's no money around. And he's really, isn't it hard to see how universities might pivot to something like this?
Yes, you were right to come to me as the guest with a slightly more cynical approach. I have to say, William Hague, the Englishman in a baseball cap. I wasn't quite so excited because it felt very much like motherhood and apple pie. And actually, I just didn't feel any of the... I mean, don't get me wrong. The vision that is outlined, yes, that is wanted. And yes, that is needed. But I think it's a vision that's been stated before. And I think we lack so many of the strategic building blocks in terms of sort of modern governance to even begin to get us there. And that's outside universities. I certainly think that there is space for universities to become more of the thought leaders and to demonstrate practice in this area by joining up. But, you know, I have to say that it takes real effort sometimes inside universities to make those interdisciplinary links from a research and a knowledge exchange perspective. I also think that some of the real sort of disablers behind a more joined up approach comes within universities, comes back to the fact that we effectively don't have long-term funding settlements for our own research and knowledge exchange, which makes things very, you know, effectively research is subsidized by the student experience, by student fees at the moment. So I think that there is lots of hope within that report in terms of the sunny uplands, but there's no vehicle for getting there. And I think, Jim, you're right, that there feels like there are much more pressing problems. I think what is interesting is the way in which this is, two things, obviously the kind of cross-party or the design of a cross-party appeal, but also this real recognition that what is required is much more joined up government in terms of more strategic planning across departments, across ministries. And certainly when I worked as a civil servant, that was still very hard to affect. I mean, I'm talking about the early 2000s. But when it did happen, it made such an impact. So I think if nothing else, if this brings back some more policy-based conversation in the right ministries, in the Cabinet Office, about why we need to effectively have a kind of revitalised industrial, economic, innovation, higher education kind of strategy piece, then I think that would be a good thing.
Now, we've got an event coming up in a few weeks. Here's some geezer called Jim to tell us more. Hi, it's Jim from the team here with news of The Secret Life of Students. Back for its fourth year, we're going to take the opportunity to get real about students, bringing together sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and students' union managers, to get an accurate and unvarnished picture of the student condition in 2023, so we can work out how to respond rather than just react. Shifting from a surface-level understanding of student satisfaction with services to a deeper understanding of their motivations, ambitions and lives can be hugely rewarding and important both for them and those supporting them. It's also vital in an age that seems quick to assume, judge and condemn students rather than listen, understand and act on their concerns. So at the event, we'll be asking questions like, what are students doing when they're not in the classroom? Where is the line between their desire to collaborate and regulations that ban collusion? Is it true they're not prepared to debate and discuss controversial issues? Why do they rate assessment and feedback so badly on the NSS? And how many are confident about being real students, let alone what comes next?
On the day, we'll feature key findings into the student experience in the past year, we'll launch exciting new research into the student learning experience beyond the classroom, and we'll launch our new student insights platform, Belong, a wonky group GTI initiative, and we'll share the first findings from its research. It's an essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's the Secret Life of Students, London, March the 14th. We'd love to see you there. Go to wonky.com/events and book now.
Hi, this is Andrew Bush from KPMG, and I'm popping into the Wonky Show to talk about the reclassification of further education colleges and sixth forms. On the 29th of November last year, the Office for National Statistics announced the reclassification of further education colleges and sixth forms into the central government sector. From that date, this requires those entities to follow the framework of financial management set out in the Treasury's Managing Public Money guidance. This has got wide-ranging implications and impacts for those entities and any subsidiary companies attached to them, and will require upfront approval from the DfE and sometimes Treasury in a number of areas. For borrowing, all new borrowing, any drawdown on existing facilities, the renegotiation of existing facilities and overdrafts will all require approval. Senior pay and remuneration will be subject to certain thresholds above which approval will need to be obtained, and that applies to certain levels of pay award as well. The proceeds from any asset disposals will need to be ring-fenced and used for future capital reinvestment. Write-offs and losses will be subject to specific thresholds above which approval will be required. Any severance, compensation and ex gratia payments will be subject to certain guidance. Any indemnities, guarantees or letters of comfort have also got specific rules that have to be followed. And where they exist, any novel, contentious or repercussive transactions will also need upfront approval. One final area that's being considered is how the sector obtains insurance and how that should be sought going forwards, and we wait further information on that. So as I started, this was effective immediately from the 29th of November, and it required those entities to react very quickly to be able to comply with this guidance. And going forward, it will inevitably require plans to be reconsidered, and I'm sure further information will be awaited from the DfE.
Now, Nottingham has a new student living strategy. Debbie, what on earth is happening here? Or there?
So the universities of Nottingham and Nottingham Trent and the Nottingham Council have got together to publish a consultation on a student living strategy. So this would be about broadly about increasing affordable accommodation in the city. For students, because you know the demand is high. It's about developing good community, or you know, continuing and fostering good community relations between kind of town and gown. And it's also about retaining graduates in the city. And, you know, what I really love about this is the whole thing is grounded in the idea that students and graduates are, you know, they're sort of seen as an asset to be encouraged rather than a problem to be managed. And of course, the sort of joint nature means that there's lots of scope to kind of do interesting stuff together. So that's kind of, yeah, that's the that's the overall thing. And it's really nicely presented as well. It's got lots of pictures of students kind of contributing to their community, and it's very kind of accessible piece of work. So I think, you know, to be highly commended all round, really.
And Paul, the thing about this piece of work is, it you know, I mean, clearly on one level, that I can imagine, you know, there's someone stood at a podium, there's someone talking about the contribution that students make to the city. But this is a really important component of the local plan in terms of the planning arrangements in the city, isn't it?
Absolutely, Jim. And I'm pleased to say this was a report that I did know was coming out. We've been working on this together, the three parties, for a few years now, actually. So this is the kind of final phase in the development of the strategy. And it really has been, you know, an awful lot of hard work behind the scenes to ensure that we were all pulling in the same direction here, because we've had a history of, you know, lots of people getting cross with each other about student behaviour, about universities not contributing, about the city council not being interested and communities being upset, councillors being upset, right? And we all got around the table and agreed that we just had to find a different way through it. And the accommodation thing was a really big part of that. But what it meant was, it was a kind of recognition of, you're absolutely right, that students as citizens and as primary members of a, you know, what is a young community in the city of Nottingham were absolutely elemental to its future success. And getting everyone on board with that idea has been really, really powerful. And collating all the marvellous things that students do in their communities, yes, dealing with the challenges as well, but showing them at their best, not just in terms of economic contribution, but the social, the cultural contribution, the volunteering they do, has been, you know, really great in terms of highlighting the contribution they make to the life of the city. And it's been a really positive thing. And that kind of vibrancy and enthusiasm, I think, does translate really well into this kind of really clear three-point strategy. We've engaged a lot of people in the development of it, and we're now looking to get everyone else's contributions as well before we finalise it and then move forward with the approach.
Yes, I mean, certainly one of my reflections, you know, as well as the kind of, you know, the gloss and the fonts and the so on all it, one of my reflections in terms of the comments from the director of planning in the council late last year was that Nottingham looks and feels like one of the few cities in the country that is genuinely on top of the relationship between housing supply and housing demand, which is to some extent being generated by bringing students to the city in a way that I think lots of other cities aren't. Selina, if I was being kind of harsh, outside of London, where, you know, obviously London's very complicated, outside of London, I see lots of universities on international students saying, oh my God, international students make a great contribution, they're really valuable and so on. But I don't see this kind of effort going in with other universities and the city to kind of make that real in terms of where students are living and contributing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one of the sort of real boons behind the civic engagement agreement signups was that it would force a conversation, I think, in a lot of cities, particularly where there was more than one universities, about some very solid commitments that they could make with the local authority. When I was at Goldsmiths, we certainly did that, and we were talking to health partners as well. I think Nottingham have done a fantastic job, because it's easy to start these conversations, but what Nottingham have done is they've stuck with it throughout the years, and it's a bit like a, you know, that rolling stone, in that now you've got the housing strategy. There will be other initiatives, I'm sure, that will come along that will enrich the life of Nottingham and its environs, but also bring other partners potentially into the fore. So one of the things I'm always interested in is, you know, you've got Nottingham College. I don't know whether or not they're partners in this conversation yet. And I know less of their students are going to be reliant on housing in the same way that the universities will. But I think that's a really important conversation to ask local FE colleges to be part of. I'm pretty sure that Sheffield have done something similar, or certainly they had a couple of years ago, in terms of talking to the city council about licensing schemes and greater involvement of the universities in the local development plan to account for increased student numbers.
Debbie, one of the things that happened when we were on our little European tour this year is that you know, the coach tumbled into a rainy Antwerp, and we go into this ostensibly student union building, and 10 minutes later we discover that the city council have funded it. So invested is the city council at Antwerp that they funded the biggest student union building in the city, with a big strategy that includes training clubs and societies on sexual misconduct to join up all the threads, because the city is interested in the conduct of students. Well, are we ever going to get there? Are we ever going to get to a point where, you know, places in the UK are so invested in students and the student experience, rather than othering students as being, you know, kind of temporary and tourists, that, you know, they do that kind of integration and investment?
Well, I think in a funny kind of way, it because one of the things that has happened, and of course, you know, Selina will be across this, you know, in spades, is the sort of gutting of local government. And, you know, the turnout in local elections is not amazing. And so, you know, and as a consequence, the kind of the power of local government to kind of respond to the diversity of its citizenry, and adopt, you know, a sort of that sort of strategic perspective is sort of fatally compromised in the last decade. And, you know, and therefore it is not even remotely surprising to me that, you know, that the focus has tended to be, you know, how do we, you know, bash the universities over the head about keeping their students under control, rather than how can we work with universities to, you know, essentially realize this enormous asset of all these young people coming into our area. But this is it. I think the more the value of this kind of thing can be demonstrated, and demonstrated to the local population as well. The thing that really struck me was, you know, the focus on things that really matter to students. I mean, we've seen political strategists like Rachel Wolf kind of endlessly saying, you know, governments are measured or assessed by their ability to make a real difference to people's lives on things that matter to them, like bin collections. And, you know, it is also true, I think, that universities and universities will be assessed and measured by their ability to, genuinely make a meaningful difference to people's lives in their communities. And if that, you know, includes getting students picking up litter, then that's the sort of thing that will, you know, gives that sort of license to exist, really, and a basis on which to build some of that more exciting stuff that you're talking about.
Can I come in there, Jeb? Because I think that's absolutely right, Debbie. And the bins and noise, right, is the fundamental challenges that we always face. And when we started down this road as the three organisations, what we were trying to do is essentially get beyond that. And I think this approach does it. The other element, which isn't reflected here, but for me is vital to this recognition of students as citizens, though, is ensuring that students are on the electoral register, they have the opportunity to vote, and they play a full part in the democratic process in the areas in which they live. And that has been a huge challenge in the past decade. And it's something that I think is still a gap in this country. We've got other challenges there, as we know, in terms of voter ID. But that is part of this picture, the bigger picture for me.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Selena, Paul, Debbie, our news editor Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. Mark will be here next week, and until then, stay wonky.